supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Artists looking at it as in World War II or the Napoleon.
The Civil War began 150 years ago and lasted 5 years, so the Rosenbach Library and Museum has commissioned Burrell to compose 5 portraits every year for the next 5 years. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
In sports, the Flyers skate against the Devils at 1 and the Sixers meet the Jazz at 7:30, both games at home. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a very unusual and interesting question of the week for you this time out. What should potential gardeners look for when they're going to buy a new home? It was so much fun to think about that. One of the most important things is I got my thinker to think of something that most people don't think about that could ruin your gardening aspirations, and you wouldn't know it till it was too late. We'll reveal what those secret questions you must ask are when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, though, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, so we're going to take that heaping helping at 1-888-346-9499. Tegan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Well, thanks for being had. Thanks for making the call. And is your name really Tegan?
It is, yes. My parents got it from a TV show called Doctor Who. But established name from back in the day in Wales.
All right. Where are you? You're not in Wales, are you?
I am not. I actually live in Brooklyn, but I have a question actually pertaining to Philadelphia.
Wow, you're all over the place. Okay,
yeah.
So go for it.
My boyfriend lives in South Philly, and he and I are trying to plan and research roof gardens because he has one of those lovely asphalt-covered flat roofs of South Philly, and part of it is covered in a deck, which is very nice, but we thought it'd be great to use that space for a garden and to also use it to help with reduce energy costs and really just beautify the space. And I'm having a hard time finding information on how to do your own roof garden. I find a lot about container gardens, but not a lot specifically about roof gardens.
Well, you know, one of the things you're kind of mixing your metaphors here, too, is the concept of a green roof.
Mm-hmm.
And green roofs are typically not walked on. It is a just a very alternative kind of roofing material that does dramatically reduce costs, put oxygen back into the air, reduce storm water runoff. They're really groovy things. Now, you say there's a deck up on the roof, so obviously there's a way to get onto the roof without climbing up the fire escape or something.
Mm-hmm. There's stairs.
From inside the house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got to tell you that plants directly on a roof do become problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Those flat roofs are already kind of water catchers and snow catchers. As you know, if they get clogged up, it's a disaster. Water does not pool off of them like a peaked roof. So you have to be very careful. But this is done very successfully in Center City, and you already have the template started by having that decking. What mm-hmm. you do when you establish decking on a roof like this is, by definition, hopefully somebody's involved who has some sort of structural engineering kind of knowledge, and they're spreading the load, they're putting the weight down in the right areas, they're supporting it, they know where the deck should come down and how it should be attached and the best way to spread the weight so that it doesn't harm the roof in any way. And that's exactly what you want to continue for mm-hmm. your plants. You know, you really don't even want to be walking on the roof itself if you mm-hmm. can avoid that. And the one of the best I ever saw, the decking, as I'm calling it, was only about 6 inches above the surface of the roof. But then the plants are not sitting directly on the roof. They're not trapping moisture under them. Their weight is being taken by the weight of the decking, making it more like a suspension bridge. So there's no chance that a big, heavy plant, once it gets saturated, is going to be seeping down and creating a soft spot in the roof that might eventually go in.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the woman who had this rooftop deck garden I used to visit all the time in the art museum area had the healthiest plants I've ever seen, despite one summer where it was cold and wet the whole time, because she had air circulation underneath her plants, which is just to die for. I mean, it's almost impossible to get, but she had achieved it. And because it is in Center City, South Philly kind of qualifies as Center City, mm-hmm. to me, the heat sink of that roof should be enough that you could have perennials up there in big pots that you might want to protect over the winter, but they should survive. If you're thinking of establishing plants like a little fruit tree or shrubs, spring-blooming shrubs, stuff like that, you want to make sure they're in a protected location and that they can take a little bit colder weather than the same plants in the ground, because there will be cold air going underneath them during the winter.
It gets really hot up there, and there's not a lot of tree coverage or shadows from other buildings on top.
It's very important. One of the things that affects the plants on the roofs is not only that blinding sunlight, but wind up there, which tends mm-hmm. not to be broken at all. So you may want to erect some, not fencing so much as lattice work or something, a pergola, you know, something, and you can even have vines going over top of that, and mm-hmm. something you could drape shade cloth over. I think it'd probably be worth the investment before you did anything to paint the roof white.
Yeah.
Painting the roof white will keep the house cooler in the summer to begin with. But I will tell you, the more you install this decking up there to create some shade, the more you put up some lattice work, and then the more you have lots of plants up there, it is going to cool things. Just make sure you follow the biggest rule of container gardening. You don't have to use pots. I mean, you can have special boxes made for you that can become kind of part of the whole decking situation. They can mm-hmm. be modular going in and out. Just make sure that whatever's holding the soil doesn't have any soil in it. You want 3/4 of a light, loose, soil-free mix, like professional mix, and you want the lightest, loosest mix you can get, and then mix in some high-quality compost with that to give it some structure and some nutrition. But soil-free mix will drain better, it'll be better for your plants, it'll keep them cooler, and it'll weigh about 1/10 of what wet soil weighs.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
All right. Well, you got lots of work to do, Tig, but it's going to look great when you get done.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. You take care and good luck.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Delwyn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Delwyn. How are you?
Doing just fine.
And where are we doing just fine, sir?
I'm calling from Seattle, Washington.
All right. So what can we do for you, man?
I have a question about composting. I have a bottle of children's multivitamins that's been sitting around open to air for over a year now, and it's absorbed some water and it's gotten kind of mushy and they're sticking together, so they're no longer really appetizing for my 4-year-old daughter, but they're still good. They haven't started to spoil, so the
right.
nutrients are still viable. And I wanted to know, we like to compost as much as we can. I'd like to know if it's safe and beneficial to add these multivitamins to my compost pile.
Well, what are you composting with in Seattle? Because I don't recall there being an abundance of deciduous trees.
Mostly leaves, because where we do have a number of large deciduous trees.
Oh, okay,
where
good.
We live. And also just our table scraps.
Okay, good. Shred the leaves up well. That sounds good. You have two choices. Yes, you could either put them into the compost pile, but I'll tell you what a lot of people do, and they don't even wait till vitamins go bad because they have this philosophy, and there is some truth to it, that plants do utilize some of the same vitamins as we do. Now, we certainly know plants utilize the minerals that are in vitamins and minerals like calcium and magnesium. But there are people who feel strongly, and there's some research to back it, that the B vitamins, especially vitamin C, that these things are beneficial to plants. So what I would do, and I actually have some old expired vitamins that I'll be doing this with this coming spring and summer, is once my plants are out and get established and it's time to give them a little bit of a supplemental watering for one reason or another, I'll take a half a bottle of vitamins, dissolve them in my watering can with like a paint stick and water, and then I'll just water that nutrient-rich, vitamin-rich water into the thirsty plant roots, right at the base of the plant. I think you'll get all the potential benefits, whereby if you mix them into a compost pile, especially in your damp climate, a lot of it is going to leach out over time before you can get the compost to the plants.
Okay.
Yeah, the only problem in Seattle is picking a time when you're allowed to water your plants. Most of the time, nature's taking care of that real well for you.
Summers are pretty dry for most of the part of the summer.
Well, then there's your time, man. Save them up for summer. Put them into your watering can and give your plants a little hit of Fred and Barney, and it'll cheer them right up.
Okay, that's good news.
I love that question. That's one of my favorite questions in a long time. Thank you, man.
All right, thank you very much.
You take care.
Okay.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind our wonderful WQUB listeners and everybody in beautiful Quincy, Illinois, that I'm going to appear on Saturday, March 5th at this year's edition of The Gardener's Palette, an annual event staged by your local Illinois Master Gardeners that's open to everybody who loves to grow. But don't you go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and the very important things you need to look for if you want to buy a home that's fit to garden. I'm Fit to Garden Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
You're listening to WHYY.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. I've discovered I'm fire. Well, actually, my home element is fire, which means that I should be eating bitter, bland, and cool foods. And that's a bit of an oversimplification for the fascinating tradition of Thai cooking, where food is both delicious and medicinal. So join us. That's this week on The Splendid Table from American Public Media. Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, PNC Arts Alive, a five-year, $5 million program of the PNC Foundation, supporting innovative arts programming with the goal of making the arts accessible to all. More at pncartsalive.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, what should gardeners be looking for when they're out there looking to buy a house? Most of you know that you should have questions about the sun and the soil, but I got something that's much more important that you really need to nail down if you think you're going to be growing anything at all. It's very important stuff you should know, and you will know it. It's coming up and the question of the week towards the end of the show. In the meantime, more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Perry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Hello, Perry. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm in Carpinteria, California.
Well, I'm so thrilled. I always love it when people know to tell us where they are. However, all I know is now you're in that giant state that takes up the entire western side of the country. What part of CA is that, Perry?
It is in Santa Barbara County, so it's about an hour and a half north of Los Angeles on the coast.
Oh, okay. Oh, and it's so beautiful. I know that area well. Okay, what can we do for you, Per?
Well, my husband and I bought a piece of land about 8 years ago that was a big field, and we planted about 1,500 avocado trees.
Avocados, that is a very California farming occupation. Congratulations.
Thank you. The property prior to our purchase had suffered a lot of erosion, so we've been mulching and doing cover cropping. But we'd like to be more sustainable and bring less in. And we were wondering if putting in compost tea would benefit our avocados. And if it did, if we could put it in the irrigation system or if it had to be applied with a sprayer.
Those are all great questions. I will tell you that if, you know, you're near the ocean, so of course you want to stabilize the soil, both for your own good and for the good of the water. I mean, any kind of runoff there is bad for the environment.
We terrace the entire property.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you're doing
yes.
Great. And I will tell you that finding good organic mulch, which quite honestly, as you and I know, can be a challenge in your part of the country because you are not.
Actually, it's not. Because, for two reasons. The County of Santa Barbara provides it for free. And secondly, the Santa Barbara polo fields are very near us, and they're always trying to get rid of their manure.
Yeah, but you have to be careful because manure, as you know, is not compost, and you could easily over-fertilize that land and reduce the yield of your avocados, which is something you don't want to do. Now, what's in the compost from Santa Barbara? Because I don't think of this area as having a lot of deciduous trees.
In Santa Barbara County, we have a substantial number of trees and forest and landscaping, and it's all from the county trying to maintain all the forest in the area.
Okay. All right. Well, you just seem to be blessed here to build up your land to really improve the soil. The more of that compost you quote-unquote import, the better. Now, I know a lot of people would argue with you as to whether you are importing because it sure sounds like it's a pretty local resource. It's not like you're trucking it across the country. So I like that a lot. That's adding organic matter to the soil. That's the best thing. What compost tea would do would provide your plants a foliar feeding or a drench feeding, either one. In your case, the compost tea would be an additional straight fertilizer and a disease preventer. Now, of course, I have no experience with avocados. They're out of my range, and I've just never known anyone who grew them at length. But I'm not thinking that they're especially disease prone, are they?
No. The only thing, you know, it's ironic. There was always a problem with root rot because they're shallow rooted.
Right.
And then they discovered that it was almost entirely eliminated if you mulched.
Right, yes, sure, because you're putting soil life down at the root level, and that soil life will attack, possibly even eat the nuisance fungi that are rotting the roots. So I think definitely from what you've told me, the advantage to you would be to water this stuff into the soil. If you begin to have disease problems on the leaves of the fruits, that's when you would want to switch to spraying it directly onto the leaves first thing in the morning. But now it sounds like soaker hoses on top of the soil, watering compost tea. I presume you're going to get a big professional compost tea brewer because of the size of your operation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I would think just run it straight from the brewer into soaker hoses and let it soak into the soil. Either cover the hoses with mulch or do it first thing in the morning. What you want to stay away from is watering systems that have tiny emitters or tiny holes that would get clogged up because there will be particulate matter in the compost tea.
Got it. Okay. That's very helpful.
Oh, no, I think you're doing so many things right already. This sounds like a sensational job you're doing, and the compost tea is just going to be like a cherry on top.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. You're doing a very responsible job with that interesting environment you're in there.
I appreciate it. We always listen to your show, so this is a thrill.
It's the closest I'll be to Southern California for a while, so I love being on the air there. All right, you take care, Per.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Laurie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Laurie. Where are you?
I'm in Princeton, New Jersey.
Oh, very good. I know that area very well. I love it. All right, what can we do for Laurie in Princeton, New Jersey?
Late this summer, we had an incredibly hot and dry spell here in central Jersey. And while I attempted to use a soaking hose to help my rhododendrons, they're in really bad shape now. And actually, when you look at them, they're kind of two branches. They're as well-established, probably 20-year-old bushes, but now I got two branches that look okay, and the rest of the plant has 6 to 8 brown leaves and a really brown-looking flower bud. And your advice has always been, don't touch the bushes in the fall. So I didn't do anything. And now it's fully dormant. And my question is, what should I do? Should I be trimming it this winter or to encourage more growth in the spring? Or should I wait and then take care of it in the spring and see if there's any chance these branches are going to come back?
I always wait because I have two big rhododendrons in the front of my house. They get a lot of afternoon shade, so they complain a little bit in the summer, but it's really the winter that makes them look as if they need to be dug up and burned in the middle of the street as like a ritual to the gods or something. And then they bloom. There's a giant balls of flowers covering everything. And then after that, that's when you can go in there and really reshape the plant after the flowers start fading. Did you feed them anything? Are they mulched?
They are mulched with actually cocoa mulch.
Okay, well, that's kind of benign. That's not what they need, but it's not going to hurt them like true wood mulch either.
And you're not going to be happy, but I did put down a little bit of azalea feed.
Well, what does that mean?
It's a commercial pellets designed for rhododendrons and azaleas.
But it's not Holytune or a natural product.
No, it is not.
Oh, you burned them.
Okay.
But you burned them.
I didn't put that down until well after the rain started falling again.
You mean in the fall?
Yeah.
Oh, man. What were you thinking?
Follow the instructions on the bottle. It said feed in fall every quarter. Suggested feeding.
Gee, do you think that has anything to do with them selling another giant bottle of that as soon as they possibly can?
Could be.
And had you used this before?
Yes.
Yeah, so you use it on a regular basis.
Basis.
Yeah, you're burning them up. You're accumulating toxic salts in the soil. And the combination of chemical fertilizer with that summer we had, that is death on a stick for sensitive plants like this. So you never want to feed them anything like that again.
Okay.
I want you to leave them alone over the winter. In the spring, I want you to buy a big bale of milled peat moss and get some compost. I don't care how you get it, but get good yard waste compost, not composted manure. Get rid of the cocoa mulch. Put that around your other plants. That is a good mulch. It's just not the mulch that rhododendrons, azaleas, and hollies want. What these acid-loving plants want is a solid inch of peat moss all around their base. And then cover that with a half an inch to an inch of compost and water that in. That replicates the conditions that these plants were, quote, born in. These are native to peat bogs. And do that early in the season because they may surprise you. You may actually see some of this brown material greening up. The response to compost and peat moss is often sensationally fast.
Oh, great.
But with azaleas and rhododendrons, I've learned this the hard way and the easy way. It's compost and peat moss. Peat moss on the bottom, compost on top, and then feel free to cut them back to anything really after they're done flowering. Cut off any dead areas for sure. But you're going to be surprised at some really ugly spuds of branches putting out some beautiful flowers this spring.
That would be wonderful.
All right?
Okay.
And sin no more with the other stuff.
Yes, sir.
All right, Lori. Good luck.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you, Richard. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I am doing just fine, thank you. And where is Richard fine?
I am in Vicksburg, Michigan, just south of Kalamazoo.
All right, Kalamazoo, zoo, 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 zoo. Excellent. Always wanted to get a call from around there. What can we do for you, Rich?
Well, here's the deal. I've got a garden that's got a lot of oak trees, a lot of shade, very little sun, and decided to start a compost anyway. So I went out and bought one of those black plastic composting bins. Had it going pretty well, and very unintentionally or unknowingly put ashes from my barbecue in it. Having heard that ashes are good, and then subsequently learned that they're not, at least not those kind. And so now my compost is dead, and it's about 20 degrees outside, and it's not going to get warm for a while. So my question is, can I revive this compost during the winter? And if not, how do I revive it during the spring?
No, you've contaminated it completely. Now, you say that you have a lot of trees and shade and tree leaves, right?
Correct.
So where is your garden? Where are you gardening?
We're not actually gardening. My wife has some flowers, and that's it, and they're kind of scattered around the house where we can find some sunspots.
Right.
So I guess I should, yeah, it's not really a garden.
And that's fine. So you have a limited need for the compost. Mostly you were fooling around trying to figure out how to make compost.
Yeah, and how to not throw everything in the trash.
Right. Very good. Unfortunately, this batch may have to go in the trash. So you collected a lot of fall leaves, right?
Correct.
And did you shred them?
No.
Okay, so you were already, the odds were against you. Whole leaves, unshredded leaves, mat down like a tarp. It is almost impossible to make compost from whole leaves. I mean, it is possible if you pile them all up in a corner of your yard, they will eventually become compost. But in Michigan, it may take 5-10 years. Whereby, okay. Well, this is lesson number one, whereby if you run them over with your lawnmower or use a leaf blower set on reverse to suck them up into the machine where they get shredded naturally and then put them in the composter, they will compost down for you very quickly.
Okay.
Now, what else did you put in there besides the barbecue ashes?
All of our cooking scraps, vegetables, scraps, fruit scraps, eggshells.
Okay, I'm going to suggest that, again, this was probably not going to become compost because I think you probably have too much green material in there for the brown. In the future, remember that the best compost is made with about 80% fall leaves and 20% kitchen waste. In truth, it is the shredded fall leaves that become the compost. Any nitrogen in the green waste feeds the composting process and makes it happen faster and better. In terms of kitchen garbage, however, the only two things that really contribute nutrition to the compost are eggshells, which put in a lot of calcium. They have to be crushed up very well. And coffee grounds, which they really contribute enormous amounts of nitrogen and other essential plant foods to the compost. If all you mix together is 80% shredded fall leaves and 20% spent coffee grounds, you will make high-quality compost very quickly.
Oh, good.
I would suggest you get a worm bin and learn how to do vermiculture with specialized redworms. You're in Michigan, so it allows you to compost year-round. You're not stopped during your 8-month-long winter. And the compost made by these worms, no smell, no fuss, no muss. They just love eating your garbage. They will take the least nutritious elements of your kitchen waste, and they will turn it into super premium compost. There's nothing better for plants than worm castings. Now, your barbecue grill, that's even worse than wood ashes. If you burned wood in a wood stove or a fireplace and added that hardwood ash to your compost pile, it would shut the pile down. But that's just because it's pure alkalinity. But barbecue ashes, the charcoal briquettes they sell in the supermarket, these are petroleum products. These are like oil and plastics and stuff like that. Most of the stuff that people are burning in their backyard, that ash really needs to go into the trash. Gotcha. There's no other good. You don't want to add it to nature. So look at all you've learned now, Rich. You're gonna you're gonna get worms under your sink. You're gonna make fabulous compost outdoors. The gardening world will be your oyster. And don't forget, there are flowers that do well in the shade you have. So don't just grow in the sun. Make sure your wife grows the coward shade garden, the Holy Trinity. In the sun challenge spots, you want impatiens, begonias, and hostas, and you'll see flowers all summer long.
Sounds great. I appreciate all of your wisdom.
Well, I appreciate my wisdom, too. It's the only thing keeping me going these days. All right, Rich, you stay warm this winter, and you're going to have a great garden next year.
Hey, thanks so much. Take care, and God bless.
You, too. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn all of the opposite procrastinators out there not to start seeds for your summer garden too early. The ideal time to start seeds is 2 months before you intend to plop the plants in the ground. A week to germinate the seeds, 6 weeks to grow the plants big and strong under intensely bright light, and a final week to harden them off in preparation for planting. But don't you start counting backwards from your last frost date just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to look for when you're buying a home in which you wish to garden. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
It's 11:18. You're listening to WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. PASA, the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, will hold their 20th annual Farming for the Future conference February 2nd to the 5th in State College, PA. A dominant theme this year will be helping small-scale farmers take advantage of the growing demand for local sustainable food. And I'll explain how easy it is for all of us to have a great-looking landscape without toxic chemicals in a free lecture for the Friends of the Wissahickon at the Valley Green Inn on Wednesday, February 2nd at 6:30. Wine and cheese reception and book signing after my talk. It's all free, but you must register in advance. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
WHYY forecast. Arctic air is here to stay for the next few days. Mostly cloudy today with a high of about 24. Tonight, few clouds about, very cold. The low 13. Tomorrow, Sunday, mostly sunny with a high of 27. Sunday night, the low dips to 8. And Monday, cloudy with a high of 19.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. What you should look for when buying a house if you intend to garden. There's some shocking surprises that you may not have thought of, but that are more important than sun and shade in your future gardening happiness. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Chris. How are you?
I'm really well. How about yourself?
I am doing very well myself, thank you. Where is Chris doing well?
Spokane, Washington.
Spokane, Washington. Okay, very good, very good. Nice to hear from our listeners there. What can we do for you, Chris?
Well, Mike, I bought a house in January of, I guess, last year now, so it's been a year, and I spent most of the year renovating the inside, gutting it. It's a 101-year-old house. It's beautiful now.
Good.
Now it's time to look to the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I got to see out of my kitchen window was the beautiful blossoms of the two cherry trees in the back. They're way too big, so I didn't think that anything would come out of them. Well, I got cherries.
And did you sample any?
I did.
And?
They were wonderful, and so I'd like to see what I can do to keep them going. I have a friend who has hundreds of acres of cherries, so I figured, okay, I'll ask him. He gave me 3 steps. 1, take out a chainsaw. 2, place it about 3 inches off the ground and cut them down as 3, and come over to his house anytime I wanted cherries. Well, that wasn't very helpful.
Right. Why did he take that tack, or is he just saying he has more than he can use?
I think he's saying that they're a lot of work for just 2 cherry trees. And
huh.
So it's not necessarily you're going to get your money's worth, but that's not the point. You know, they're beautiful, they're ancient. According to the neighbors, they're about 25 years old.
Right, so the trees themselves, even if they hadn't put on fruit for you, a 25-year-old ornamental cherry is going to have spectacular bark, a lot of character as a tree. You have trees that actually look nice most of the year.
It's true.
And
I lucked out.
The springtime show is unparalleled. You know, I can't imagine anyone who would cut down a cherry tree if they had seen 1 year's worth of the blossoms. And they are sweet cherries, right? Eating cherries, not pie cherries, not sour cherries.
That's correct.
Huh. Okay, well, obviously sweet cherries are a little bit more difficult to grow than sour cherries, which are the typical trees that would have. But if you're able to eat them out of hand without adding lots of sugar to them, you have sweet cherries. Now, how many did you get as opposed to the birds?
Well, I bet you half the birds got. Between the birds and the squirrels, my kids got about a quarter of them, and I think I attempted the other quarter before they fell down and became sort of ground cover.
Yeah, and did you experience any problems whatsoever? Were there worms in the fruit? Did the trees become diseased? Were there any problems, or was this just a fun thing where you had to fight every other creature in the world to get some of the cherries?
You know, it was just a fun thing. I just wanted to keep it that way is what I'm hoping we can do.
I don't see any reason that you shouldn't be able to keep it that way. Cherry trees traditionally do not require any pruning. Now, as you probably know, you know, I'm talking to the choir here, they are typically standard trees. Even if they're sold as dwarf cherry trees, they get big. So I imagine yours are fairly tall.
A little over 50 feet.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you're never getting the cherries from the top anyway,
no.
Let's be honest, because that's why they call those big machines cherry pickers.
Right.
That's the only way to get the ones up at the top. So, no mulch, no artificial fertilizer. They would love a nice mulch of compost underneath the plant. That would reduce competition from other plants, be a natural barrier against disease should you have an especially wet spring. You don't need to do anything to facilitate the cherries. If you wish to try to open up the tree, if it gets too crowded in a certain area and you start to see mold or mildew in there, feel free to take out entire branches over the winter or in early spring. Obviously, you'll sacrifice the blooms and the cherries. And you should always prune out any dead branches that you see and that you can reach safely. Other than that, any pruning is optional. There's no reason you have to prune this plant unless it's diseased or dead or broken. And then when the cherries begin to appear, that's when you want to start to think about some sophisticated bird netting.
Okay.
Or aiming a couple of motion-activated sprinklers at the tree. You would aim them at the cherry-filled parts of the tree, and then when a squirrel or birds came in to try to eat the cherries before you, the sprinkler would come on, make a noise that scares them, but then it throws cold water at them. And that's a very effective deterrent. Most people will net small trees, but clearly there's no way you're going to be able to net the top of that tree.
That's a lot of netting.
Really, just, you know, it's like Woody Allen said about 90% of success. Just be there. Just show up. Yeah. Just be ready. I think you got a huge bonus with your house, man.
Well, thank you.
I'll think of you this spring. I can only imagine. Hey, send us a picture of the two in bloom, and we will put it up on our website.
Great, I'll do it.
All right, man?
Thank you.
All right, good luck.
All right, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Aaron, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Aaron. How are you?
I'm doing great.
And where is Aaron doing great?
I am in Riverside, Ohio.
Riverside, Ohio. Now, where are we here?
It's by Dayton.
Oh, okay. Okay, very good. Our good friends in Dayton. Now, we haven't heard about Riverside yet. About time you spoke up. All right, what can we do for you, Aaron?
Okay, so this summer we are going to Europe for, like, all of July. And our garden is fairly large. My father calls it a commercial garden. And he is the plant manager in our house.
Right.
He loves all stuff with plants. So, usually he gets about 60 tomato plants for our garden.
60?
All different types.
60?
Yes, 60.
Okay, so he doesn't want to go overboard, right?
Oh, he wants more. I don't like eating tomatoes.
Not anymore. Aaron used to love them, but now...
My rest of my family loves them, but I don't.
Okay.
So my question is should we, since we're going to be gone for like the month of July, should we be planting 60 this year, or should we, 1 year we use container tomatoes? Would that be a better idea?
No. Container's worse.
It is.
Yes, because this garden is, he's going with you, right?
Yes.
Okay, so theoretically, there's not going to be anybody around?
No, we're going to be gone, and it's very large, and no one wants to mess with it.
Okay, so here's the things you need. Certainly, don't plant anything that's going to fruit heavily and need to be picked during that month. He should get his tomatoes in as late as possible, so there is not a lot of fruit ripening up during the month of July. You said you're in Ohio, so typically if you time things right, you can get most of your tomato and pepper harvest in August and September. Everything needs to be in the ground because containers dry out 5 times faster than plants in the ground. And the ground needs to be covered with a solid 2 inches of shredded leaves, straw, or other non-wood mulch. That'll moderate the watering needs. So I'm going to suggest late planting. Get the plants up to a good size. Do not overfeed them. If he feeds these plants chemicals, they're not going to last for a month on their own. They would have to be fed only compost. And then the most important thing is to have that 2 inches of mulch over top of everything. That'll keep moisture in the soil. It'll stretch out any rain you get, and it will prevent weeds from taking over the garden. An abandoned garden in July is Weed City. But as long as the plants are in the ground and well mulched, I think he'll come back to a considerable amount. You're always going to have losses in situations like this, but I think he should come back to a garden that can be reclaimed in a couple of days.
Okay. Thank you.
All right?
Yep.
All right, Aaron. Good luck, and have a great time over in Europe.
Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Buying a home that's fit to garden. Our question this week comes from Jason and Amy, who call themselves garden amateurs in Columbia, Maryland. They write, Mike, my wife and I are starting to shop around for our first home. I want to grow vegetables, tomatoes, peppers, herbs, etc., and maybe plant a fruit tree in whatever little bit of land comes with our townhouse. What garden-related qualities should we look for when comparing various properties for sale? Is there a particular time of day that our plants will need sun? And is there a quick way to estimate the quality of the soil? Thanks. Well, thank you for asking a great question, and one that maybe I should have asked when we bought our first and still only home some 25-plus years ago. although I had been gardening for a few years and had moved to our area to take a job that would eventually lead me to become the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, I nonetheless thought first of the school district that our then imaginary children would attend. Then, of course, came an affordable price. And so we wound up buying Snow White's old house in the woods, which is great when the birds and chipmunks drop in to help with the dishes, but not so great when the drama queen vegetables complain about the lack of sun. To wit, I always wanted to say that, you want morning sun for your veggies, that fruit tree to be named later, and any disease-prone ornamentals like roses, lilacs, and dogwoods. Not afternoon sun, which I don't think any plant prefers, and you want at least 6 to 8 hours of total sun a day on the majority of those veggies. Oh, ignore that moaning and clanking noise in the background. That's just the ghost of tomatoes past rattling their chains of shade. Now, this advice is specifically directed towards Jason and Amy's Baltimore, Washington area and similar climes. One size does not fit all when it comes to garden sun. The further north and or the cooler your climate, the more full sun all the time becomes something between ideal and basically required. The further south and or the hotter your gardening region, the more you begin to absolutely need some afternoon shade. Now, I wouldn't sweat the soil too much, as soil can be improved a lot easier than the hours and times of sunlight. And I'm going to nag you and almost everybody else on the planet into building raised beds for most plants to avoid your crappy soil anyway. Now, if somehow you have the choice, sandy soil is better than clay. Sandy soil can be improved and made close to perfect by the addition of large amounts of organic matter. Improvement of clay soil involves a backhoe and a dump truck. But now we come to the issues that are more important than sun and soil, and which few new homeowners anticipate, leading to years of gardening frustration. And not the kind of gardening frustration I experience when squirrels replant my tulip beds with black walnuts. And that is the given home restricted in outdoor use by a homeowners association, management rules, local ordinance, or other governing body? It's really important. I get dozens, maybe hundreds of heartbreaking emails every year from people who moved into a, quote, townhouse or similar dwelling and then learned on the back end that they were not permitted to have a vegetable garden, fruit trees, or even certain ornamental plants. So be sure and ask direct questions on these topics, and do so in several different ways. First, tell the sellers or their agents that you intend to garden, and ask if there are any rules that will prevent your free use of plants. Then take a different route. If there's no sun out back, say directly, "We'll be planning to have a small vegetable garden out front. Are there any issues with that?" Accept no evasive answers. And any responses that sound even vaguely like, "Well, we typically don't allow that, but I'm sure they'll make an exception for you fine folks," should be taken to mean it will be a tropical winter in northern Iowa before you grow tomatoes here, pal. To this point, try to avoid buying the house in winter when there's not going to be a lot of visual cues around. Consider it a warning flag if you're there in spring or summer and there's no evidence of gardening anywhere nearby. Conversely, a tomato cage in every yard would be a very positive sign. And finally, if the home is in any kind of a shared community and has grounds utilized by all the residents, ask about lawn care and chemical use. People who buy a smallish home without much ground probably already realize that they're going to have to use a lot of containers and maybe join a nearby community garden to feed their addiction. But people who are determined to avoid toxic chemicals are often dismayed and worse when they learn that their yard or the large area right next door is getting hosed down on a weekly basis with some kind of green-colored liquid from the back of a tanker truck, and they can't do anything about it. Learn these things on the back end after the papers are signed and you are screwed, blued, and tattooed. It may make the search a little more difficult up front, but be prepared to hold firm on your principles and keep looking. Because as many sad listeners have told me over the years, there are few things worse than being tied by a mortgage to a home you've come to loathe. Well, that sure was important information about buying a garden-friendly house now, wasn't it? Luckily, yous can review the question of the week in print at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to pass a local ordinance prohibiting me if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please, please, please tell us where you live. Please, please, please put the actual subject in the subject line, not the word question, and check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our alphabetized archive of garden answers, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Fred Snyder. Rich Banowitz is our webmaster. The newly named Sarah Kazar is his faithful assistant from the Savage Land. Our regular intern, Jessica Mandick, is, well, we think she's back in Disney World again. Waiting patiently for her trip to a warm place in the winter instead of just being stuck here working with Goofy is Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Just back from taking Pluto for a walk is our editor, Al Banks. I'm the third spook from the left in the middle of the haunted mansion, Mike McGrath. And you know, come to think of it, how come Goofy gets to wear pants, but Pluto doesn't have to? What's going on with that? And yeah. And I'll see you next week. Many people are curious about the cultivars known as currants. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll reveal what these fruits need to produce their distinctive berries. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike wades through a cacophony of information about gardening to offer a cognizant and clarifying store of knowledge on anything having to do with plants every Saturday.